Hey everybody, welcome to The Checkup. I'm Simon Rettner. Today we speak to the Pulitzer Prize winning composer, bandleader, saxophonist, flautist, conceptual artist, Henry Threadgill. Back in 2016, I got the opportunity to interview him right after he won the Pulitzer Prize. And ever since then, it seems as though the composer is energized more than ever, putting out new music and forming new ensembles at the age of 74. In this conversation I'll be bringing to you, he speaks frankly about addressing his life in music throughout his career. We cover a broad range of topics, the enfolding and outfolding strategies that he employs that he took from the 20th century composer Edgar Varèse. For Threadgill, everything is about movement, and that is exhibited on his recent recordings, Dirt and More Dirt, in Threadgill's new ensemble he calls 14 or 15 Kestra AG, AG as in aggregate, combining all of his ensembles over the years, Zouid, Double Up, and much more. So, in this show, we'll be bringing you this conversation with Henry Threadgill with selections from both of these new recordings. This is The Checkout. I'm Simon Rettner.
Music has no meaning. That doesn't mean anything. It has no meaning. Tom dropped his wallet. That has a meaning. Red with a dash of pink and blue to it has no meaning. Music, you can't, that's why you say, you could say this has a sound like Indian rhythms. Everybody can come away with a different impression of a work of art. That's what I like about art. The larger meaning of music, of art is universal, is that like all kinds of people can come away with their own meaning, can come away from it with that they can get something from it on their own, in their own terms. We don't have to have a scale or certain conditions have to be met. I go look at a picture, you go look at a picture, and both of us come away with a whole different thing. But we both get something. That's the point. It leads to something. It don't have to be the same thing. That's not necessary at all.
What do you get out of hearing your music? For instance, let's just say your most recent music, which you've added another piano. You have three pianos now to your double up ensemble. When you listen to that, what do you take away from it?
I don't really listen to it so much. As a recording is one thing. When it happened live, I hear it more as a live thing because I've heard it so much. By the time we get to the studio, I enjoy the recording, but not as much as I do with it live.
It's a much different experience, yeah, too. I have to say, like, what you hear on the album is nothing what you'll hear live either.
Right.
It's completely different.
And I don't make music for me to listen to. I make music for the public. See, that's my soul in. What I do is for humanity. I don't make it for me.
When did you come to that realization? You've always felt that way?
Yeah. More so now. It's become far, far clearer to me in the last 10 years. It's more clear than ever before that what I do is for people.
So now, in this moment in time, in the first time in 15 years, you've created a new band.
Right.
But sort of adopting the same principles, approaches, mm-hmm, structures that you've employed in, mm-hmm, the past in Zooid.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that Edgar Varese,
mm-hmm,
and his principles of just creating organized sound, made an impression on you early,
right,
in the game.
Right.
Are we thinking about his pieces like Emmerich, or,
yeah,
his more famous pieces, Ionization?
All of those pieces, all of those from that period. I even met Varese when I was in college in Chicago. But
it's Varese, that's how you pronounce his name, Edgar
Varese. When I first heard his music, it struck me that it was totally different from the other modern music, the modern music of the time, which was more was serialism. But it was only about, when I moved to India, that I discovered something in his music that I started looking at physically. I was listening before, I started looking at the music, and I was looking at processes, how he was processing things, and I saw a way that he was processing the material. You know, there's these different ways to process material, what they call development techniques. He had a whole different way of developing material. It was a couple of principles I saw up in his. He was doing something where he was flipping two pieces of material, what he called enfolding and outfolding in a way. In other words, he'd have these two things like this, right? And he'd flip them. This was a development technique, right? So you could flip it this way, or you could flip it that way, right? You take this and flip it like this, or you flip it this way. So it was infolding and outfolding. But anyway, that gave me an idea about what I was working on at the time. And I took that principle further, much further than what he was doing. Because I was looking at it for a long time. I was looking at what he was doing with it. And it kind of bothered me. I said, I wonder how come he didn't take the next obvious step. There was another step that I was amazed that, like, maybe he saw it, maybe he didn't. But I saw this next step. And it said, all of a sudden, this door opened. I said, wow, look at this, you know. All of a sudden, a whole new world opened up.
I want people to gain deeper understanding, have a deeper connection to the music they're hearing. So I've heard your hand metaphor where you switch the thumb on the pinky in terms of form, if the form has, it's the same hand.
But people are not going to really get it. It's far too complex. It's too theoretically. I can break things down sometimes just for a conversation with someone. But like in the short sense, we will work on a series of intervals. Let's say that there were five intervals and music was being created from those five intervals, right? Only. So that meant that everything had to fit. Because that's the only thing that exists.
At any time.
Exactly. So that means that everything had to work. There was nothing extraneous. As long as you didn't violate the rules, that means all your movement, this dancer could only move in this type of way. That don't mean that if there were five, that don't mean that you used all five. You could use two. You could use three. You could use four and then use one. Use three and then use two. So the people in Zuid knew how to do things over and beyond what was there, how to bring in other ideas and make them and integrate them into that. Their own individual musicianship and understanding of things, they had learned how to bring all of their information into this. So what would almost appear to be a violation of the rules, if there are any rules, there are no rules. In the end, there are never any rules. And the only reason you can say that is because something works. If it doesn't work, then somebody broke the rules.
As long as it's good, then it's within
bounds. Exactly. Rules are only there. They're guidelines to show you everything that works. But they're not the end in themselves. It doesn't say that you can't go beyond them. You know, you have to make it work then.
Obviously, you look at your music, especially you and Butch Morris and a lot of the artists, maybe even of your generation, like process, structure, approach, could be perceived as being more important than the music itself in a way. You're making conceptual art.
Yeah.
Just musically speaking, what really moves you?
You got to remember, like a film, like a play, even a so-called static work of art, it has to move. It has to move. One thing, what advances, as they said, what advances the action? Everything has to advance to the next action. Every act has something in it that advances to the next moment.
Like a plot point in a film.
You can't have something and it just stops and static.
Then it's dead.
You can't have that happen. And you're watching a stage play. All of a sudden, you get this vacuum stuff. Things stop. It just comes to a dead halt. It's done. The piece is dead in the water.
Right.
So there aren't any moments in anything that I like more than any other. You know, the funny thing about that, I don't hardly teach. Sometimes I've assisted people, and in a workshop or something, and somebody would come in with this material and show it to me, say, you know, I can't get any further than this, and I got these couple of ideas. You know, generally, a lot of times, your best ideas is the ones they say, you have to kill the baby. You get something, you're so focused on, this is so beautiful, this is so pretty, that's what's in the way. That's what you really need to kill. It's true. Because it's stopping the flow. See, the flow is everything. You have to have the flow in dance. You have to have the flow in everything. There has to be a flow. You can't just be standing up looking at something and it doesn't go anywhere. You know, you're reading a book, you know, it's not taking you over to the next page. You know, you say, you read this page and then the thing just stops. And you go over to the next page and say, what am I reading this for? It's supposed to carry you forward. It's supposed to pick you up. You're supposed to be on this train. That's my feeling. Art, you get attached to it in that moment and it takes you somewhere. You see people stand up in the galleries and they look at work. They're engaged and it's taking them somewhere. It has failed when it doesn't do that. It's different reasons why things could fail. The art might have failed. Conditions might have failed for people to appreciate something. But there's a culturalization problem.
A culturalization problem.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, people have just been disconnected to the culture, cultural information. Basically, intelligent information, you know, don't understand that the world is not flat or any such thing as that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So they're standing up and they're confused. They don't know that infinity has already been discovered, and now they're looking at something and it bothers them that infinity is in this picture. They don't understand zero. You know, now they've been counting from one. See, these kind of things, that's a culturalization problem. Or there's more than one religion on earth. You know, there's tall people, there's short people, you know. That's a culturalization problem, you know. So therefore, people can't grasp something. So the work might not have failed. Society could have failed. The individual.
Thank you. Fred Gill joins us on the checkout. Congratulations to him for winning the Pulitzer Prize In For a Penny, In For a Pound, his Zooid recording and his new recording on Pi. So when you look at somebody like your friend Butch Morris and his conduction, his approach, and then you look at other people that are experimenting with forms, I'm just really fascinated by artists.
Some form or something.
I'm just fascinated with the zeitgeist of an era, you know, and the artists that are all sort of friends with each other, inspired by each other. It's almost like a variation on the same theme. I mean, the concept, the approach, the way of looking at the music structurally is so bold that it almost fits in line in a sort of parallel universe to what you're doing. Do you see similarities in what Butch Morris was trying to do with conduction and spontaneous composition?
Sure.
In what you what you are doing?
Yeah. I mean, we were searching for, you know, looking for a smoother and a bigger and broader canvas, and to get into it unencumbered, you know, without boundaries and stitching.
Mulhall Richard Abrams was a big part of that as well, right?
In
your early years. Did you guys talk about that in Chicago?
You didn't have to talk about it a lot of times because we was experiencing it from one person's work to the other. We was playing each other's works. Of course, you had conversations with some people, you talk about things, but you didn't have to because you were going to hear it anyway.
When you think back to that time and the work that was being created, what are your thoughts?
I was like very lucky. Now, you know, you think about it, to be a part of this group of artists in Chicago, the ACM, that was like a unique moment. We never thought about it that way. We just was plunged together, put together in this circumstance, and like we just kept going forward and had no idea that we would get to this.
So you had no idea.
50th year anniversary last year. We had no idea, you know, we weren't planning on it. But everyone kept producing and producing along the lines that they produce. You know, what people used to write and still would say the AACM school. There's no such thing as an AACM school. If it's anything, you have to put an S on the end of it. Schools. Because there is no singular. It's only plural, you know, because there is no singular concept. There is no concept. Everybody was a teacher.
Okay.
Everybody was a teacher. You were there because you were there to create your music, and that was the basis of you being there.
That's it.
If you didn't have anything to create, then you shouldn't be there. People that came in had nothing to contribute along that line, came in and left. If there was a documentation of all of the people that came in and left the ACM, it's a very large list, but it was those that had something to really contribute, to work on, that stayed.
Well, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the AACM, Jack DeJohnette released a recording, Made in Chicago. Mulhall Richard Abrams, Larry Gray, Roscoe Mitchell, and you, Henry Threadgill, you wrote a piece for the occasion. Leave, but don't go away.
No, leave, don't go away.
I know.
Yeah.
Leave, don't go away. What does that mean?
I never try to explain anything. I mean, you know, just I let people figure out things for themselves. You know, It's nothing to explain. I don't want to get put any one idea in people's mind about anything. Changes for me, and it changes for me on a regular basis. I say something today, it means one thing to me. Tomorrow, it changes my understanding of something. So I don't like to fix anything, you know.
Is it nostalgic for you to play with those guys?
No. Because we were playing everything for the first time. We weren't resurrecting any kind of repertory literature or anything. That would have been nostalgic, you know. But we weren't resurrecting anything or bringing anything back from the past. If I could flip the word nostalgic over like heads or tails, it was on the other side of nostalgic, ever what that might be.
The opposite of nostalgic.
Right.
The most invigorating.
Yeah, it's invigorating. And it had a past. It was like, you know, these associations that went all the way back. And we had never played together in this configuration at all, you know. And so it was, and have known each other all this time and have played together for so long in different groups, you know. But this was so new, you know.
Speaking with Henry Threadgill on the Checkup, and he has a couple of records out. The record in which he won the Pulitzer for is called
In for a Penny, In for a Pound.
That's right. In for a Penny, In for a Pound is an English phrase which basically means if you decide to steal an apple, let's say, because you're hungry, you might be put in jail and the consequences might be far worse than that risk of stealing something small. In your career, as you look back, what do you consider to be the riskiest thing you've ever done, Henry Threadgill?
I once got on a bicycle on a turnpike in Boston. That was a serious mistake.
What happened? What do you mean?
I almost got killed out there. A bike that had two gears on it.
In Boston?
Right.
Why did you decide to do that?
I don't know. It was a mistake. It was a series. it was a bad moment.
What about
a
calculated risk?
I've taken a lot of calculated risks. Music is a calculated risk.
When you were exploring these new intervallic structures,
those things are not risky.
Did that feel risky to you?
No, that's not risky. No.
Okay.
That's not risky at all. You know, you have to, these are things, you know, you're going to be a type of stylist in your life where you're going to be a person that keeps moving forward. This is generally the case. When you look at the work of different artists, they either become stylists or they keep pushing forward. I've always kept going forward. I never stopped and stayed in one period of what I was doing. But as soon as I get some information that opens me up to more expression, that's what it does. It opens you up to a greater level of expression when you get more information, you know. So, and I don't consider, some people might think it's risky, say, well, why would you do this? You're going to alienate people because they might not. I said, I can't concern myself with
that.
Well,
some people would say putting 3 grand pianos on the stage would be risky.
No, I don't deal in that. That's not my department. I can't predict the weather and know if whose foot is going to hurt if it rains and, you know, who's going to feel bad if there's 10 pianos in front of them. That's really not my department, I'm telling you.
Thank you. Henry Threadgill, the Pulitzer Prize winner of 2016, Jason Moran's favorite composer of all time, joins us on the checkout today. As a composer, what can you achieve with three pianos that you can't with two, though, seriously?
Well, what is that going to achieve with two that I can achieve with one? It's not just the pianos, it's the piano players. It's the people that play the pianos, too. It's the entire ensemble. There's not a lot of pieces for three pianos. Mozart had one, and it's got reduced back to basic two piano. He started doing it for two pianos. Daniel Barenboim had put out a recording, I think. But the thing, what you can do is, like anything, three tubas, three anything.
Four guitars,
exactly. But this is not just notated music. See, it's the element of surprise and new invention is there. The sensitivity involved, two people on a high wire is one thing. Three people on a high wire is a lot more riskier, but the yield, what it can produce, is incredible. Dangerous, open for a lot of failure, but on the plus side.
So what musical setting have you felt the most vulnerable in your career?
I don't know, again.
Okay.
The piano work is the most vulnerable right now because I've taken all this time. I didn't really write for piano until just late. I'll be coming out with my new ensemble called 14 or 15 Kestra. K-E-S-T-R-A colon A-G-G. That's aggregation. 14 or 15. This is all of my groups together. This is Zewitt.
Oh, man.
Zewitt with brass. Zewitt with brass is Zewitt plus two trumpets, two trombones, and upright bass. And double up. And that's 15 people. So this guitar, Liberty will be playing guitar, and Tress. David Barres will be playing piano and harmonium. Then two trumpets, two trombones, upright bass, cello, two percussionists.
I guess the bass and the cello.
And then and three alto saxophone players. And myself and Roman Field will be playing alto flute and alto saxophone. And I'll be playing flute, bass flute, and alto saxophone.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to some of that music right now. I love the fact, Henry, that you love to tell stories, and you can just get lost in so many of these interviews you've given in the past of just incredible anecdotes, imagery, just an incredible life that we all can learn from. And after speaking to one of the musicians that you've played with a lot, Ruben Candeli, that sings your praises, told me about this story. And since we're talking about Butch Morris too, because he also served in Vietnam, Ruben Candeli says that when you served in Vietnam, that you heard John Coltrane in the jungle. And I would be curious if you'd be willing
to heard him in the jungle.
In Vietnam somewhere, you heard...
Oh, we had tapes. No, I heard Coltrane. I knew Coltrane when I was a kid.
I know you knew John Coltrane, but when you were in the war, you are somehow...
We were listening. We had music that we were listening to that everybody had carried over there, you know.
Okay.
Everybody had music. We'd be playing it there, you know. We'd be playing Coltrane and Soundstrap. Ornette's music. Those were two of the pieces, some of the composers' works and saxophone players' music that I had with me that I was listening to. You could hear it playing in the jungle.
So give us some pieces. What were you listening to?
With Dahomey Dance, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
on that's Lonely Woman and all those pieces I had with me at the time. But other musicians also had music too, you know. I had something, I think I had Unit Structures too. Cecil Taylor, I think I had that there, listening to it, you know.
In some of my most trying moments, stressful moments of my life, I know music got me through it. Like, I can only imagine that listening to this stuff in Vietnam must have been necessary.
You know, it's like you see a person carrying a teddy bear. You see a lot of girls or women who carry a teddy bear. It's like a little comfort thing. Something that you know in the unknown. You know, you push somebody all the way out of space or all the way over in Mongolia somewhere. They got their teddy bear, they feel a little bit better. You know what I'm saying?
Do you feel like any of those early experiences in your life influenced you as an artist?
Everything has influenced me. That's what I've been learning. Everything, it comes home that you know, everything that I've learned about Earth, life forms, human behavior, information, culture, groups of people, everything is what has informed. That's what informs artists, I believe, period, you know. Right now, I'm just fascinated again with the animal kingdom, again with birds and fish, and with a particular pig right now. When you can slow down enough to pick up some information, you know, just not so much what you hear, but what you can observe, the behavior of species, you know. That can be extremely informative, you know.
Well, Henry Threadgill, it's been a pleasure and honor spending some time with you, listening to your music.
Appreciate it. It's nice to have the station come in and support what I'm doing and play my music for the audience that you all have. You know, that's what everything is about. All I can hope for is that what I do can get in front of people. You know, and let them decide for themselves if it's relevant for them, you know. That's all, you know. That's enough, you know. I just push the tray of food out and just see who can push it in front of.
new music from the groundbreaking composer, the Pulitzer Prize winning saxophonist and flutist Henry Threadgill. And throughout this show, we've been listening to selections from both of his brand new recordings, Double Up Plays Double Up Plus, and music from his new ensemble, what he calls 14 or 15 Kestra AG, AG shortened for aggregate, dirt and more dirt. And we thank Henry Threadgill for spending some time with us, speaking to us from his Lower East Side apartment. If you like this show, definitely make sure you stay locked on to the podcast, which is on iTunes and Stitcher. And if you go there to subscribe to it, definitely give us a review while you're there. We like all the positive feedback. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rentner. Thanks for checking us out.